curfews and Nazis. He raced to his house, ran up the stairs to the apartment, and opened the door to find his father dozing in his chair in his worn suit and tie. The lights were on, and a newspaper lay on his lap. Sandro went to his side.
Papa?
His father opened his eyes, concerned.
Oh, I must have dozed off. How's Rosa? I would have gone to the hospital but for the curfew. Where's your mother?
Rosa's fine. She has something intestinal, and Mamma decided to stay at the hospital.
Good.
His father's frown eased.
I expected you sooner. Have you been at the hospital all this time?
No.
Sandro didn't hesitate.
I went to see Elisabetta, and before you say anything, I love her and she loves me. As soon as the race laws are repealed, I'm going to ask her to marry me.
His father lifted a graying eyebrow.
Mazel tov.
Sandro blinked. You don't disapprove?
After all we've been through. This war has left me tired of fighting. If you love her, then marry her. You're a wonderful son. You should be happy.
His father opened his arms, and Sandro hugged him, moved.
Thanks, Papa.
Now, let's get to bed.
They did, and Sandro fell asleep to the sound of rain, his slumber deep and peaceful. But it was only a few hours before he and his father were awakened by a pounding on their door. Chapter 96. Sandro, 16th of October, 1943. Sandro woke up. It took him a moment to realize that someone was banging on their door. His slumber had been so deep that his head ached. Only hours ago, he had been with Elisabetta in her rooftop garden. He jumped out of bed, turned on the light, and hurried to the door. His father scurried behind, hooking his glasses behind his ears. It began to dawn on Sandro that something was terribly wrong. The Pontecorvo boys were crying downstairs. There was shouting in German outside. Boots thundered on the cobblestones. The heavy engines of trucks rumbled in the distance. Sandro twisted the knob just as the door flew open. Two helmeted Nazis burst into the apartment, one short and one tall, armed with submachine guns.
Mani in alto!
The short Nazi shouted, pointing his gun at Sandro and his father. Sandro gulped with fear. He and his father raised their hands, the two of them terrified, standing in their undershorts. Sandro struggled through his fright to think clearly. He didn't know what the Nazis wanted. He wondered if it had to do with their defiance of Captain Meyer. But the noise outside told him they weren't alone. The short Nazi kept the gun trained on them. Rain dotted his helmet and wool greatcoat. The tall Nazi crossed to the telephone and cut the wires, then began searching the apartment. Sandro's heart hammered. He didn't dare look at his father. At least his mother and Rosa were safe. The short Nazi dug in the pocket of his greatcoat, pulled out a wrinkled sheet of paper, and thrust it at them wordlessly. Their hands still in the air, Sandro and his father looked at the paper. It was a list of everyone who lived in their apartment house, with their ages and dates of birth. It must have come from the community's records, taken from the synagogue. His name and his father's were next to his mother and Rosa's.
Vo,
the short Nazi pointed to his mother's and Rosa's names.
Vo, vo.
Sandro knew the word meant where in German. The Nazi was asking where his mother and Rosa were.
Tot,
he answered quickly, which meant dead.
Was ist?
The tall Nazi pointed at Rosa's bed, which they had squeezed in next to Sandro's. Sandro thought fast.
Tot, the two of them last week.
Hier.
The short Nazi handed Sandro another paper. Sandro and his father read it together, horrified. 1. You and your family and all other Jews belonging to your household are to be transferred. 2. You are to bring with you A. Food for at least 8 days. B. Ration books. C. Identity card. D. Drinking glasses. 3. You may also bring A. A small suitcase with personal effects, clothing, blankets, etc. B. money and jewelry. 4. Close and lock the apartment slash house. Take the key with you. 5. Invalids, even the severest cases, may not for any reason remain behind. There are infirmaries at the camp. 6. 20 minutes after presentation of this card, the family must be ready to depart.
Sandro's hand trembled as he held the paper. They are being taken to a labor camp.
20 minuten,
the short Nazi shouted. Then the Nazis left, slamming the door behind them.
Sandro reached for his father, and they clung together. His father had never felt so thin and frail. Sandro wanted to weep, but he couldn't surrender to emotion. Thank God Mama and Rosa are at the hospital. They're safe.
Yes, but we had a deal with Kepler.
His father broke their embrace, agitated.
We held up our end of the bargain.
You think they're taking 200 of us? Is that what's happening?
It has to be. They're not honoring the deal. This is bad faith. A material breach as a matter of law.
But what can we do now? We have to go. We can't make a legal argument.
There must be law. There must be honor. We met with Kepler himself.
Papa, we have to get ready. We don't have time for a legal discussion. The law won't help us now. The Nazis are the law.
Sandro hurried back to his bed.
We made an oral contract, son.
His father stood still, shaking his head.
We performed our side of the bargain. This is a clear breach.
Papa, we need to get dressed.
Sandro put his identity card and clothes in a backpack, and his father went to the cabinet and took out his shirt.
I assume Almansi and Foa will call Kepler. He'll have a lot to account for, that's for sure.
Don't forget your identity card.
Sandro packed drinking glasses and ration cards.
I'll get the rest.
I wonder how Kepler will justify this. It's simply indefensible.
I have the keys.
Sandro took them from the drawer and pocketed them.
We'll leave the door unlocked for Mamma and Rosa.
The Vatican will intervene, of course.
His father put on his shirt, shaking his head.
Justice will prevail in time. We will be sent home from the labor camps. Colonel Kepler's word was binding.
Sandro got his notebook, tore off a blank page and grabbed a pencil, realizing it would be the second note he had left tonight. He started to write his mother's and Rosa's names, then remembered that he had told the Nazis that they were dead. He wrote instead, "Don't worry about us. We'll see you when we can. We love you." Sandro set down the pencil.
Are you ready?
Almost.
His father knotted his tie.
Put the note in the can of tea so your mother finds it. You know how she loves her tea.
Good idea, Sandro said,
wondering anew about his father's state of mind.
He doubted his mother would be making tea when she got home and found them gone.
He left the note on the table. Chapter 97. Marco. 16th of October, 1943. Marco woke up to find his father bent over his bed, already dressed. For some reason, the light was on in his bedroom.
What, Papa?
Get up. We have to go.
His father's expression was grim.
The Nazis are mobilizing around the ghetto.
Marco thought instantly of Sandro. He flung aside the sheet and leapt out of bed. He could hear his mother praying in their bedroom.
I thought it was too quiet last night.
His father pursed his lips, shaking his head.
I should have known they were up to something.
Are the others coming?
Marco crossed to the chair, grabbed his pants, and slid them on.
In time. We're closest, so we're on our own. The Nazis are cordoning off the ghetto. They're setting up roadblocks at the synagogue. Via del Portico d'Ottavia, via the Sant'Angelo in Pescheria, Piazza Costaguti and Piazza Mattei.
Fear constricted Marco's chest. Sandro and his family live near Piazza Costaguti. He threw on his shirt and buttoned it up.
A German convoy is heading down the Lungotevere de Cenci.
Marco jumped into his shoes.
How big is the convoy?
30 trucks with escorts and more coming.
His father left the bedroom, and Marco bolted after him.
Oh, no, that's a huge operation.
Yes, and the tracks are empty. The Nazis are going to fill them with people.
His father hustled down the stairwell with Marco.
How can that be? The ghetto gave them the gold. That was the deal.
I think the deal was a ruse to buy time. They never intended to keep it.
What? Why?
It takes time to stage an operation this big. They must have been planning it for a while. It's why they arrested the carabinieri.
His father reached the bottom of the stairwell and hustled to the stockroom with Marco at his heels.
So you think they're taking 200 Jews?
His father opened the storeroom door and turned on the light without reply.
Papa, are they taking the 200 anyway?
His father met his eye, wearing an expression that Marco had never seen on his face. A mixture of sorrow, anger, and determination.
Son, I think it's too many trucks for only 200.
What do you mean? Marco asked, his heart pounding. What are you saying?
I think the Nazis are taking all the Jews. I think they're emptying the entire ghetto, like they do in Germany. It's a rastrellamento.
Marco cursed. No, that can't be. Everyone?
Everyone.
His father reached behind the cans on the shelves where they hid their pistols. Marco felt shocked, struck dumb with horror. But then he experienced a darker emotion. Pure rage. His father retrieved two guns, pocketed one, and handed Marco the other.
It's loaded.
Let's go,
Marco said, palming the gun. Chapter 98. Marco. 16th of October, 1943. Marco and his father raced up the Ponte Fabrizio. Rain fell in sheets, drenching their heads and shoulders. They reached the crest of the bridge and got their first look at the ghetto. The sight horrified and enraged them. Hundreds of Nazis swarmed the other side of the river. A barricade cordoned off the ghetto from the rest of Rome. A long line of covered trucks blocked the Lungotevere de' Cenci. Kubelwagens were parked everywhere. Nazis guarded a barricade at the foot of the bridge, and a crowd had gathered there. Marco realized his father had been right. It had to be a rastrellamento, a roundup of the ghetto Jews. There were too many Nazis, too many trucks, and too much activity for it to be otherwise. He never would have believed that anyone, even the Nazis, could get away with this in Rome, under the nose of the Vatican. Marco and his father ran down the bridge, slowing as they approached the back of the crowd, which was distraught. Men and women comforted each other, clinging together, praying and crying. Marco struggled to maintain control of his emotions. The heavy trucks rumbled in idle, spewing exhaust. He simply could not allow Sandro and his family to be loaded onto them and taken to a labor camp. Marco whispered to his father.
We have to do something.
No. We wait.
For what? We can't just stand here.
Marco's fingers encircled the handle of the gun in his pocket.
Don't. You'll get everybody killed. Be patient.
Suddenly, a burst of gunfire came from the north side of the ghetto, where Sandro lived.
No!
Marco cried out, startled. His father shot him a look. A wave of fear ran through the crowd. Women gasped, men cursed the Nazis. An old man shook his head, tears filling his cloudy eyes. A woman covered her face, sobbing.
Papa, I have an idea.
What?
Follow me.
Chapter 99. Sandro. 16th of October, 1943. Sandro left the house with his father, holding a small bag of belongings and some bread. Nazis filled Piazza Costaguti, shouting orders, shoving terrified families into lines, and holding barking German shepherds. Shouting and crying echoed from other streets. Earlier there had been gunshots. Sandro and his father joined the line of families forming diagonally across the piazza. Nazis held them at gunpoint, their faces shadowed by helmets. The bedraggled families huddled together in the pouring rain. their expressions drawn with fear. Sandro suppressed dread as his father shivered next to him. He spotted the other tenants from their house in their line. The Pontecorvos, with their three boys, Giacomo, Carlo, and Dattillo, who kept crying. The Lanzanas, with their girls, Amelia and Aida, and the boys, Alvaro and Giuseppe. Nazis were rousting neighbors from their houses. The Di Consiglio family. Esther, with Ada, 6 years old. Marco, only 4. Baby Mirella, not even a year old. The Sabatello family. Giovanni with Graziella, Letizia, Italia, and Franco. Liana, only 8 years old. Sandro saw some of his students, their young faces showing abject terror. Families clung to each other. Husbands comforted wives. Mothers sheltered children from the rain like hens expanding their wings. Everybody held suitcases and small bags. They were being made to wait while other families were prodded into line at gunpoint. Sandro realized that the Nazis weren't counting people. That meant they weren't taking only 200 Jews. There were already more than that lined up on Piazza Costaguti. He scanned the scene and came to a terrifying conclusion. The Nazis must have been taking all of the ghetto Jews. It was an inconceivable horror, but the evidence was all around him. Men, women, children, without exception, old and young, able-bodied and infirm, carried in chairs by their family members. He could see the evidence all around him. It was a rastrellamento, a roundup. Sandro fought back his fear. He couldn't succumb now. He had to save his father and himself. He struggled through his panic to figure out a way to escape. He evaluated the surroundings. Their line faced south toward Via del Progresso. The Nazis would probably lead them down that street, then to Via del Portico d'Ottavia, the main entrance to the ghetto. There must be trucks parked on the Lungotevere de' Cenci waiting to transport them. That would explain the mechanical thrumming vibrating through the air, even in the rain. Sandro's mind raced. There had to be a way out. A group of Nazis guarded a roadblock directly behind them, which cut off Via Renula, due north. He counted how many. 10 Nazis. Too many to get past. Ahead lay a smaller, narrow street, Via in Publicolis, that led to Via del Piatto. A lone Nazi stood at the far end of Via in Publicolis, but no blockade had been set up. The Nazis on Piazza Costaguti weren't looking that way. No one was. All attention was focused on Via del Progresso. Sandro kept his eye on the Nazi on Via in Publicolis. The line of families shifted forward, but he took his father's arm and discreetly held him back. They kept their position, letting other families go in front of them. His father glanced up questioningly. Rain dotted his spectacles and flattened his sparse hair to his head. Sandro shook his head slightly. No. He was wondering if he and his father could take down a Nazi. The chance was slim. But it was, nevertheless, a chance.
Chapter 100. Gemma. 16th of October, 1943. Rain pelted the window of the hospital room, and Gemma awoke in the chair next to Rosa's bed. She had slept surprisingly well, since the hospital had fed both of them last night, the first good meal they'd had in ages. She felt relieved to see Rosa still sleeping peacefully, her color mildly improved. Salvatore appeared in the threshold, his expression grave. His white coat was rumpled, as it was the end of his shift. He motioned her into the hallway, and Gemma rose and crossed to him. "What's the matter, Salvatore? Did you get test results?"
"No, but I have terrible news." Salvatore placed a steady hand on her shoulder. "The Nazis are rounding up the ghetto. They started early this morning."
"What?" Gemma asked, shocked.
Tears sprang to her eyes. She shook her head. No. Arrastra lamento. This can't be happening. It can't be. Massimo and Sandro are home. I have to leave. No, Gemma, don't. You're safer here. We have a plan in place. What are you talking about? The Nazis are on their way here. They're coming to take the Jewish patients. We're going to move, Rosa, right away. No, Gemma gasped, stricken. We have to act quickly. We're setting up an isolation ward for the Jewish patients. Why? Gemma recoiled. You'll be doing the Nazis' work for them. You know us better than that. Salvatore's expression softened, his eyes sympathetic. Giovanni has a plan to save Rosa and everyone else. How? What sort of plan? Gemma knew he meant Dr. Giovanni Borromeo, the hospital administrator. Giovanni was a brilliant physician and professor of medicine, but she wanted details. Allow me to explain.
Chapter 101. Marco, 16th of October, 1943. Here's my thinking. Marco ran with his father back over the Ponte Fabricio. The ghetto is cordoned off at the Lungotevere de' Cenci. That's where the trucks are. That's where the Nazis are bringing everyone, right? È vero. His father ran, unbothered by the rain. They reached Tiber Island, ran past Bar Girosport, and ran over the Ponte Cestio. So we should approach from the north end of the ghetto, at Piazza Costaguti, the opposite end, away from the action. There will be roadblocks there, but they will be more lightly guarded. Understood. The Nazis will be busy at the south side of the ghetto, not the north. Marco and his father took a right turn and ran up the Lungotevere degli Anguillara, on the west bank of the Tiber. Yes, and the north side is closer to the Simone's house. If the Nazis are lining them up, that's where Sandro and his family will be. His father looked over, his dark curls dripping. Let's pick up the pace. Marco accelerated. Lights were going on in the houses along the river. Phones would be ringing. People would be waking up to horrific news. His heart hammered like a piston. His legs churned. His breath became rhythmic. Raindrops slaked his face, blurring his vision. He shook them off and kept going. He matched his father, stride for stride. Chapter 102. Sandro. 16th of October, 1943. Sandro kept his eye on the lone Nazi guard on Via Impublicolis. The line of families had shifted forward enough. He and his father stood directly across from the entrance to the street. Sandro shifted his gaze to the Nazis guarding their line. They stood at a distance, near its head. They weren't looking in his direction. He checked Via Impublicolis again. The Nazi there had turned away too. It was time for Sandro to make his move. He squeezed his father's arm, signaling him. His father looked up. Sandro shifted his gaze. They took a step toward Via Impublicolis. Just then, two more Nazis approached the lone Nazi on Via Impublicolis. One lit a cigarette, cupping the flame against the rain. Sandro's heart sank. It was too risky now. He quickly nudged his father back in line with the other families. He racked his brain for another means of escape. He needed a subterfuge of some kind. Maybe he could tell the Nazis that he had left the gas on. Gas came on for mealtimes, and it was around breakfast time. The Nazis wouldn't want to start a fire that could rage out of control. He decided that it wouldn't work. The Nazis probably wouldn't let them both go back to the apartment, only Sandro. He didn't want to leave his father. Their line grew longer, extending almost all the way across the piazza. His gaze fell on the other families. He knew all of them. The elderly Angelo Fornani, with Alberto and little Alberto, 6 years old. The grandmotherly Teresa Campagnano, with Vito and tiny Donato. Augusto Capon, an older gentleman whose daughter had married the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Enrico Fermi. The Scudi family was crowded into the line.
but Matteo Scudi was having a problem controlling his elderly mother Aurelia, who had become senile and often said inappropriate things. Aurelia began shouting curses at the Nazis, and Matteo tried to silence her, placing his hand over her mouth. Sandro, his father, and the other families turned to watch in alarm. Nazi guards rushed to Matteo and Aurelia and tore them forcibly apart. Aurelia cursed the Nazis louder. Matteo begged her to stop. Suddenly, one of the Nazis struck Aurelia in the head with the butt of his gun. A gruesome fan of blood sprayed from her head. She dropped to the cobblestones, spasmed, then went motionless. Matteo screamed, and his wife held him, turning him away from the agonizing sight. Aurelia was dead. Sandro felt tears film his eyes. His father covered his mouth, stunned. The line recoiled, and children cried louder. Rain drenched her body, and her blood spilled in the crevices between the cobblestones with the rainwater. The Nazis stepped over her. They left her lying there, cruelly. Sandro looked away, shocked and terrified. His thoughts were frantic. He had to think of something. He and his father had to escape, and it had to be soon.
Chapter 103. Gemma, 16th of October, 1943. Gemma hurried to push the gurney bearing Rosa down the hospital hallway. The Nazis were on their way. Rosa and the other Jewish patients had been given a sedative to avoid the risk of any emotional outburst, according to Giovanni's plan. Gemma had to hope it would work. She was betting Rosa's life on its success. Gemma tried not to think of what was happening in the ghetto. She could only pray that Massimo was taking care of Sandro and himself. She couldn't leave the hospital until Rosa was safe. She felt torn between her two children, both in mortal peril. She remembered that Sandro had wanted to stay at the hospital last night. If she had said yes, he would be here, safe. Instead, she had barely kissed him goodbye. She tried to remember the last thing she had said to him. She thought it was, "Good boy." She should have said, "I love you." How had she not said, "I love you"? She took a right turn down another corridor, near her old obstetrics and gynecology wing. Her years as a practicing physician came back to her. She knew the freshly painted white walls, the waxed tile floor, the bulletin board with posters for lectures that she was too busy to attend. She'd had such a sense of purpose in those days, but nothing mattered like today. The entire hospital had swung into action, executing Giovanni's plan. Nuns and lay nurses were setting up the isolation ward. Jewish patients were being identified and moved there. The staff worked as one, for no one was better in an emergency than physicians and nurses. She took a left turn and lined up behind other doctors, nuns, lay nurses, and orderlies. She spotted doctors she knew from endocrinology and rheumatology, and nuns and lay nurses from labor and delivery. They were all moving Jewish patients into the isolation ward. She had never felt more honored to be among them. In time, Gemma wheeled Rosa into the isolation ward, to a bed by the window. Rosa slept soundly, and Gemma kissed her on the forehead, struggling to remain in emotional control. With God's help, this would not be the last time that she kissed her daughter. Gemma helped move all of the other Jewish patients into the isolation ward, and after it had been filled, the doctors returned to their rounds and the nurses to their stations. It was all according to Giovanni's plan, which required them to pretend that this was a normal day at the hospital. She stood outside the closed door of the isolation ward with Sister Anna Domenica. They both looked over to see Salvatore striding toward them, his expression grim. "Ladies, it's time,"
Salvatore reached them. The Nazis are downstairs, 20 of them. They're talking to Giovanni. He's going to tell them the cover story and stall them as long as he can. Leonida is typing a patient list now. All of the names will be false. She'll stall them too. Gemma suppressed her fright. The thought of Nazis in the hospital terrified her. Gemma, we need to hide you.
Of course.
Gemma had been so focused on Rosa and the others, she hadn't thought of herself.
What about a supply closet?
No, they'll search everywhere.
What should I do? Should I pose as a patient in the isolation ward?
No, we need you.
But between my clothes and the weight I've lost, they'll know I'm Jewish if they find me.
Sister Anna Domenica interjected. Gemma, they won't find you if you do what I say.
Chapter 104. Marco. 16th of October, 1943. Marco and his father raced up the span of the Ponte Garibaldi. They gained momentum on the downward slope. Rain gusted in sheets off the Tiber. Clouds blackened the sky. Rome was awakening. People appeared on the street under umbrellas. Traffic was picking up. Marco feared that they were running out of time. He accelerated, and so did his father. They reached the end of the bridge and ran up Via Arenula, a major artery north of the ghetto. His father glanced over, his broad chest heaving.
Marco, we won't make it in time. We need to change plans. Take Via del Pianto.
Okay,
yes. Even so, there may not be time.
We have to try.
Of course.
Chapter 105. Gemma, 16th of October, 1943.
Gemma and Salvatore stood in front of the closed door of the isolation ward. According to Giovanni's plan, Salvatore was pretending to be the head doctor of the ward, and she was a nurse, dressed in Sister Anna Domenica's habit. It turned out to be the perfect disguise, since its voluminous black folds disguised the unhealthy thinness of Gemma's body, and its stiff wimple and veil covered her hair. Giovanni and a Nazi captain were striding toward them, followed by a cadre of Nazi soldiers. Gemma stiffened with fear, and even the sight of her old friend Giovanni didn't reassure her. He was in his 40s, with thinning gray hair, large almond-shaped dark eyes, a gray mustache, and a calming smile. The Nazi towered over him, a heavy-set man with a square jaw, in a greatcoat dotted with rainwater. Giovanni motioned to the Nazi.
Captain Weber, please meet Dr. Cristiabello and Sister Anna Domenica.
Captain Weber, pleased to meet you,
Salvatore said, extending a hand.
You too. Captain Weber shook his hand.
Giovanni cleared his throat.
Dr. Cristiabello, Captain Weber and his men are here to arrest our Jewish patients. I've informed him that we keep no records of our patients' religions. He and his men have searched the hospital. They have found no Jewish patients. Your isolation ward for patients with syndrome K virus is the only place left to check. However, I have informed him of the extremely contagious nature of the syndrome K virus.
Thank you, Dr. Borromeo.
Salvatore turned to the Nazi, his manner professional.
Captain Weber, I am in charge of the isolation ward, and tell me about the syndrome K virus. In layman's terms, syndrome K is a lethal and highly transmittable virus. If you or any of your men enter this isolation ward, you will contract the virus. In addition, if an infected soldier takes the virus back to his unit, he will infect everyone in proximity.
Gemma kept her lips sealed. There was no such thing as the syndrome K virus. It was a brilliant ruse fabricated by Giovanni, exploiting the germophobia of the Nazis. The name of the ersatz virus was an inside joke, as the K in Syndrome K referred to Field Marshal Kesselring, the Nazi commander. Weber nodded, his lips tight. How does the virus spread?
It's airborne, which is the deadliest means of transmission. We believe it attacks the brain. Early symptoms occur in 2 or 3 days. They are headaches of excruciating severity, then paralysis, and death.
Salvatore cleared his throat.
We suspect that Syndrome K traveled here from Africa via human host. As you know, Italian soldiers fought in North Africa. Libya, El Alamein, Benghazi. We can only imagine the bacteria they returned with, and the Syndrome K strain is foreign to European soil. Its lethality is such that no doctor goes inside that ward. Even the families of these patients aren't permitted to visit them.
How do you treat them? Weber asked, as the Nazi soldiers standing behind him exchanged nervous glances.
There is an elderly nun who has volunteered for the task. She enters only in an appropriate mask and gown, but that is insufficient protection. She is already experiencing headaches. Soon she will be a patient herself.
You are quite a coward, doctor.
Salvatore didn't blink. I must consider the greater good. We can't afford to lose a physician. We're understaffed as a result of the war. Frankly, nothing helps these poor souls. They're dead in 2 weeks, in agony.
Weber frowned.
I wish to see for myself.
Salvatore didn't move.
I implore you, do not enter the ward. You can look through the glass window.
Weber peered into the ward through the glass. The Nazi's cold blue eyes scanned the beds, including Rosa's. Gemma felt her heart beat harder. Seconds passed like hours.
Weber sniffed. The patients merely look asleep. I assure you, they are dying. They are heavily sedated on morphine. Are any of them Jewish?
I don't know. We are a Catholic hospital. We treat the sick. We can provide you a list of their names. I believe a secretary is preparing the list as we speak.
So I've been told, but it's taking too long. My orders are to arrest the Jewish patients, no matter how sick.
Weber frowned, and the Nazis behind him exchanged nervous glances. Salvatore folded his arms.
I understand that you have orders. However, I warn you, your men will die as a result of following them. Is it worth killing them for perhaps a single Jew who will die anyway? Won't your superiors blame you if they contract Syndrome K? What will happen to you in that event?
Weber fell silent in thought. Gemma held her breath. The Nazi soldiers shuffled their feet, restless.
Weber nodded. We'll take our leave now, doctor. A prudent choice, Captain.
Chapter 106. Sandro. 16th of October, 1943. Sandro's mind raced, but he couldn't come up with an escape plan. Nazis swarmed everywhere with guns and dogs. There was no realistic way out. They would be shot. More families were forced to the line at gunpoint. No age was too young or too old. Sandro fought an increasing panic over whether they were truly going to a labor camp. He didn't see how children or babies could work. Every home was being emptied. He shifted forward as the Spizzichino clan joined the line. Settimia, Adelaide, Allegra, and Alberto, with the children Enrica, Franca, and little Mario, who had just started walking. Sandro's gaze landed on his father, who stood beside him, his head tilted down against the rain. His father's hair dripped in rivulets down his neck, exposing the pinkness of his scalp. His nape had thinned so much that it was hard to see how he held his head up. Sandro put an arm around his father, and his father looked up through his rain-spotted glasses.
"Papa, I love you," he said simply.
"I love you too, son."
His father smiled shakily.
"They can't take that from us, can they?"
"No, they cannot,"
Sandro answered. But he thought, "Even if they take everything else."
Chapter 107 Gemma, 16th of October, 1943. Gemma raced to the hospital exit, desperate to get to Massimo and Sandro. Her black robes flew behind her, as she had stayed in the nun's habit as a disguise. She hadn't gotten to say goodbye to Rosa, who was still under sedation, but she felt assured that her daughter would be safe now that the syndrome K ruse had worked. Gemma reached the door, flung it open, and launched herself into the downpour. She could hear the thrumming of heavy engines from Trastevere. Bar Girosport was closed. She ran up the Ponte Fabricio, heading to the ghetto. No one else was on the upward slope of the bridge. Cold rain drenched her veil and shoulders. Random gunshots echoed from the ghetto. Her heart pounded with terror. She ran up the span as fast as she could. Her habit grew heavy as it got wet. Her body had gotten so weak. She reached the crest of the Ponte Fabricio. The sight left her breathless with horror. Nazis had cordoned off the entire ghetto. Beyond the barricade, men, women, and children were being lined up at gunpoint, huddling together like gray shadows in the rain. Nazis were herding them all into trucks blocking the length of Lungotevere de Cenci. Gemma realized that Massimo and Sandro could be among them. She was too far away to make out their faces in the downpour. Tears of sheer fright sprang to her eyes. She felt something mentally snap inside her. She was trained for an emergency, but never one like this. This was the worst thing she could ever imagine. Massimo and Sandro were being taken away. All of the ghetto Jews? Everyone she knew? She raced down the slope of the bridge. She reached a crowd of onlookers and shoved her way forward. Men and women moved quickly aside for her, making the sign of the cross on their chests. Gemma kept going, beginning to sob. She felt as if she were losing her mind. She couldn't believe this was happening. She had to get to Massimo and Sandro. She reached the barricade, which was guarded by armed Nazis. "Massimo! Sandro!" Gemma found herself grabbing the sawhorse, and in the next moment, she was trying to yank it down. The Nazis whirled around to face her, raising their guns.
Chapter 108 Marco, 16th of October, 1943. Marco and his father reached Via del Piatto, a narrow cobblestone street lined with homes on the north side of the ghetto. They stopped running, panting hard from exertion. There was no roadblock, and only a lone Nazi guarded the path, turned away to face Piazza Costaguti. Marco felt for the gun in his pocket. He considered picking the Nazi off. His father stayed his hand again.
"Don't. We're too late. Look."
Marco shifted his gaze. Beyond the guard, a line of families was moving out of the piazza, toward the loading zone at the south side of the ghetto. Change of plans.
What?
After the Nazis arrested the carabinieri, they held them at the Collegio Militare before they shipped them north. They'll do the same thing now. They're creatures of habit. No place other than the Collegio Militare can hold that many securely.
Agree.
Marco understood. He had gone to the Collegio Militare many times when he had worked at Palazzo Venezia. The Collegio Militare was used by the Defense Ministry to train officers, and special ceremonies were held in its elegant courtyard. He couldn't imagine what it looked like full of hundreds of distraught civilians.
We could be at the Collegio Militare in 15 minutes, over the Ponte Mazzini. If we left now, we would be in place before the trucks arrived.
Marco disagreed. Maybe, but I want to go back to the ghetto entrance. I want to see the Simones with my own eyes. There's still a chance they won't be taken.
There's no chance of that, son.
But I know Sandro. He'll think of a way to get away.
Not this time.
His father looked pained.
They're all being taken.
I want to see Sandro.
Marco spoke from the heart.
I need to.
Okay. We go back.
His father turned around, and the two of them took off running, back down Via Renula, over the Ponte Garibaldi, and on to the Lungotevere degli Anguillara. Nazi trucks plowed through Trastevere streets, arresting Jews there too. Marco and his father ran faster, fueled by desperation. They were superb athletes, and endurance cyclists. They'd logged kilometer after kilometer on country roads, city roads, and back roads. Never before had they asked so much of their bodies. Never before had so much been required. They bore down and flew. Their chests heaved with exertion, but they ignored it. Their thighs burned, but they didn't feel it. They had wind to carry them. They had energy to burn. They accelerated into the rain and the storm.
Chapter 109. Gemma, 16th of October, 1943. The Nazis aimed their weapons at Gemma as she tried to pull down the roadblock. One Nazi menaced her by raising the butt of his gun. She ducked instinctively, and the crowd reacted with outraged shouts.
Stop! She's a nun! You can't shoot her! God will punish you, Nazi pig!
The Nazi swung the butt of his gun at her, but a man in the crowd yanked Gemma backward. The gun butt cleared her head but landed on her forearm. Gemma cried out in agony. The pain stunned her. The onlookers reacted with horror, hollering anew at the Nazis. The Nazis menaced the crowd with their weapons. Men spirited Gemma away from harm through the crowd. Tears poured from her eyes and sobs racked her body. All she could think of was Massimo and Sandro. She struggled to get back to the barricade, even as the men brought her to the side of the bridge and eased her down.
Sister, how is your arm? They asked her. Is it broken? Did those bastards break it?
Let me go. I want to go back.
Gemma shook her head, sobbing.
Massimo! Sandro!
Sister, you can't. They'll shoot you. You must stay here.
Suddenly, Gemma saw two figures running over the bridge, their outlines unmistakable. It was Beppe and Marco. They stopped at the sound of her shouting, then turned to her.
Gemma!
Beppe called to her, uncomprehending.
Chapter 110. Marco, 16th of October, 1943. Marco, his father, and Gemma stood together on the Ponte Fabrizio, watching the Nazis do their worst. They marched a line of families toward the trucks, menacing them with guns and barking dogs. Fathers in the line protected children who wailed in terror. Wives clung to husbands and wept. Grandmothers covered their faces. Invalids and the aged were carried in arms or on wooden chairs. Nazis loaded families like cattle. Once full, a truck would take off, driving north on the Lungotevere de Cenci, heading for the Collegio Militare. Marco, his father, and Gemma held each other, praying that Massimo and Sandro wouldn't be among them. They stood in mute fear as family after family was loaded into the trucks, and truck after truck took off, driving north. The line seemed to be diminishing in time, with no sign of Massimo or Sandro. Marco felt his hopes lift against all odds. Maybe Massimo and Sandro had escaped, as Gemma and Rosa had, and were hiding somewhere in safety.
But then Massimo and Sandro came into view, walking side by side in the rain. Gemma wailed in anguish, and Marco's father held her tight.
Sandro!
Marco yelled. He waved his arms. Sandro snapped his head around, spotted Marco and nodded. Next to him, Massimo gave a little wave, a heartbreaking flash of an open palm. Then father and son were loaded into the back of the covered truck. Gemma collapsed, and Marco's father gathered her up and took her home. Marco stayed behind, standing as a witness. Sandro and his father were being taken away, and there was nothing he could do to help them. He had never felt so enraged or so helpless in his life. Tears welled in his eyes. The Nazis loaded Sandro's truck until it was full, then latched its back and drew down its canvas flap, as if crime could be covered by mere cloth. Marco watched as the truck bearing Sandro and his father lurched off and disappeared up the Lungo Tevere de' Cenci, with the others heading to the Collegio Militare. Marco's tears poured down like the rain.
Chapter 111. Elisabetta, 16th October, 1943. Elisabetta slept like a baby, dreaming that she and Sandro were getting married. She saw herself in a beautiful white dress, Sandro in a dark suit, and everyone gathered around them, smiling and happy, even Nonna. Elisabetta's parents were there too, watching and smiling, happy and whole, together as a couple. Her mother looked beautiful, and her father, good-looking in his bohemian way, with his beard trimmed and his eyes sparkling with animation, not dulled by drink. Marco was in the dream too, darkly handsome in his dark suit, for he was Sandro's best man, and in a way, he was hers too. She would always love Marco, and Marco would always love her, and she, Sandro, and Marco would love each other the way they always had, from as long as they had known life. Gnocchi and Rico were there too, watching from their own cloud that was nowhere near the edge of any roof, and there were tall tomato plants and peppers and basil and oregano growing all around them, and white roses climbing trellises and pink bougainvillea covering the walls, and purple and white wisteria dripping from a perfumed bower among cypress trees and tall curving palms. In her dream, love was a garden she had grown for Sandro. Elisabetta woke up alone in her bed. She realized that Sandro must have carried her down, then left. She felt a pang of regret at not having said goodbye, but a warm rush of love filled her. She could remember the taste of his kiss on her lips and his touch on her body. Soft gray light filled her bedroom, and she reached over to scratch Gnocchi's chin. Gnocchi moved her head around, making sure no spot was missed, having observed that humans often became distracted during prolonged stretching sessions. Elisabetta heard a woman scream outside. Gnocchi swiveled to the sound, and Rico woke up. She rose, threw on her bathrobe, and hurried up the stairs to the roof. She crossed to the front of the rooftop, horrified at the scene on the street below. Nazis were arresting her neighbors, the Diorio family, Michele Diorio, his wife, Augusta, and their two little girls. Michele tried to protect Augusta, and the little girls cried as they were forced into a covered truck. Other families were already inside, clinging to each other. Elisabetta gasped. She couldn't imagine what was going on, except that she knew that the Diorios were Jewish. The loud rumbling of heavy trucks emanated from the Lungo Tevere Sanzio, reverberating in the rain. She felt a bolt of fear, thinking of Sandro. She hurried downstairs, dressed quickly, and flew out the door.
Chapter 112. Marco. 16th of October, 1943. Marco ran up the Lungo Tevere Sanzio with his father, having left Gemma at the house with his mother. Covered trucks were driving away from the ghetto, heading up the Lungo Tevere de Cenci and turning left on the Ponte Mazzini. Marco and his father caught sight of the Collegio Militare, a massive rectangular edifice with a grey stone facade at its entrance and lower floors, changing to lighter stucco at its second-floor balcony and upper floors. Crisscrossed bars covered its oblong windows, making a grim presence on Piazza della Rovere, only a kilometer away from St. Peter's Basilica and Vatican City. Marco wondered what was going on behind the Vatican walls. He hoped Emedio and others were trying to help. He prayed the Pope would intervene on behalf of the Jews. Nobody had before, even after the race laws. The Jews were forever on their own. Marco kept running, fighting a sense of dread.
Chapter 113. Elisabetta. 16th of October, 1943. Elisabetta ran through Trastevere, past Nazis on motorcycles. Jews were being rounded up throughout the neighborhood. Shutters and shops stayed closed. No one was on the street. She had to get to the ghetto. She kept running, splashing through puddles, finally reaching Tiber Island. She took a left turn over the Ponte Cestio and raced past Bar Girosport. It was dark and closed. Marco and his family must already know. Elisabetta kept going, distraught. She prayed this wasn't a rastrellamento. She hoped she wasn't too late. She tore up the span of Ponte Fabricio. Rain pelted her face and soaked her dress. She reached the crest to a horrifying scene. There was a roadblock in front of the ghetto. Nazis were ordering men, women, and children into covered trucks, which were pulling away. She ran down the bridge, frantic. A crowd stood in front of the roadblock. She jumped up and down, hoping for a glimpse of Sandro. She didn't see him. She tapped an older woman next to her. "My God, what is going on? Is it a rastrellamento?" "Yes," the woman answered, crestfallen. "I just saw my oldest friend loaded into a truck like an animal." Elisabetta felt her heart break. "No, no, it can't be true. They're not taking everyone, are they? They can't." "I tell you, they are. I've been standing here all morning. They are taking every Jew they can get their hands on. They're emptying the ghetto." Elisabetta couldn't surrender to panic. "My boyfriend, he lives on Piazza Costa Gutti. Have they taken from the north side already?" "I don't know. My advice to you, go to the Collegio Militare. That's where the Nazis are taking them. Your boyfriend might be there already." Elisabetta turned around and took off.
Chapter 114. Sandro. 16th of October, 1943. Sandro scanned the courtyard at the Collegio Militare, trying to figure out a way to escape. He had never been here, but he was getting the lay of the land. The building was an elegant two-story edifice of classrooms with floor-to-ceiling windows, each one topped by intricate scrollwork. A vaunted colonnade ringed a vast stone courtyard, and at the front of the colonnade were five graceful arches under the Latin motto Romana Virtus Romae Dicitur. Roman valor is learned in Rome. The refinement of the building belied the horror of its use today. Terrified families filled all of the classrooms inside, and the rest were outside in the courtyard, like Sandro and his father. They stood under the colonnade trying to stay out of the rain. They sat in groups, covering their heads with jackets, clothes, and newspapers, Women held children and nursed infants. Men stood and prayed in circles, as today was the Sabbath. Nazis conferred at a security desk at the front of the courtyard, or walked among the families, brandishing their weapons and intimidating them. New truckloads of families would arrive at regular intervals, and more terrified men, women, and children would be packed into the courtyard, which was already full to bursting. Relatives, friends, and neighbors recognized each other and reunited tearfully.
"Sandro, please, rest a bit."
His father sat under the colonnade, his back against the wall of the building.
"I'm fine."
"What are you looking at?"
"Just looking."
"It's good to know that your mother and Rose are at the hospital. We can only pray they're safe there. Please, sit."
"I'm fine, Papa."
Sandro eyed the courtyard, wondering if Elisabetta had found his note. His heart wrenched at the thought of leaving her, Rosa, and his mother.
"Sir, I'm not Jewish,"
yelled a woman, threading her way through the crowd to the security desk at the front. Sandro watched the woman speak to the Nazis, then she joined a group of people being lined up on the left. He realized that the Nazis were releasing Gentiles who had been rounded up accidentally. Sandro blinked. Maybe there was a way.
Chapter 115. Elisabetta, 16th October, 1943. Elisabetta ran back over the Ponte Fabricio, heading for the Collegio Militare. Her heart lodged in her throat. All she could think of was Sandro. She reached Tiber Island and kept going, turning right up the Lungo Tevere Sanzio. Her mind raced with questions. When had he gone? Why hadn't she awakened? A wave of guilt overwhelmed her. If she had been awake, she could have convinced him to stay. She could have delayed him. If she had, Sandro would be safe with her now. She stumbled and almost fell. She straightened up and started running again. She had to get to him. She had to see if she could help him. She had to tell him she loved him and would always. She powered forward, running hard in the rain.
Chapter 116. Marco, 16th of October, 1943. Marco and his father reached the Collegio Militare, where armed Nazis had cordoned off the building's entrance. A distraught crowd thronged outside the barricade. Men and women waved notes in the air, hoping to communicate with their loved ones inside.
"Marco, listen."
His father drew him close, his chest heaving.
"You stay here. I'll go around the other side. I'm hoping one of our friends will be here."
Marco knew that his father meant their fellow partisans.
"I'll look too."
His father took off, and Marco scanned the faces around him, but saw no partisans. He threaded his way to the front of the crowd, then overheard two Nazi guards talking on the other side of the barricade, having a mundane conversation in German. The Nazi on the left was saying that he loved Servelatwurst, but the Nazi on the right preferred Bratwurst, saying his wife never overcooked it. Marco got an idea. He approached the Nazi.